Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea.
So, Greg.
Hey, happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday. I just realized that email of yours with the new intro is still sitting in my inbox.
Yeah.
That was supposed to get done, but yeah.
Oh, well. Next time.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Anyway, happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday, everyone. What topics do we have on tap this week, Greg?
All right. A great set of questions on impartialism in ethics, changing names with marriage, accusations of date rape, and more.
Yeah, it's a pretty hefty set of questions, so hopefully we will get through all of them. Folks.
Okay.
If you're listening live, you can post questions and comments in the text chat that's over at philosophyinaction.com/live.
Excellent. What's been going on this week?
Last weekend I missed the show. As you guys know, I was in Atlanta participating in this really useful workshop on self-improvement with a bunch of friends. And I've got lots of ideas to bring to the show, lots of reading that I want to do. That's going to be my project for September, is to read a big backlog of books that I've been wanting to read. And so that was all good, and I've just been catching up since then. And but Greg, why don't you tell us, because Tammy had a race yesterday, so why don't you tell us how she did?
Oh, it's great. Yeah, I recall that after she dominated this other local race, this little thing called the Race to Ruby Creek, the hardest half marathon in the nation, she broke her foot the very next day because a little ankle biter took her out on our green belt when she was just kind of out there stretching out her legs. And so she's been recovering, and today was her yesterday was a test run. She was just going to go out and try out her foot to see if she could make it 32K and not have a serious problem. And she was under strict orders: do not go big, do not get nuts with it. Yeah, came in second.
Yeah.
That's her slacking off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tammy the slacker.
Yeah.
I agree. Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah. No, and the pictures on Facebook look fabulous. So go,
yeah,
Tammy.
You can see the look on her face. She was really thrilled just to
just
like, I want to go running.
I know. Yeah.
Like a little puppy dog. All right. So anything else?
Yeah, I think let's go ahead and get started.
Okay, jumping in. Impartialism in ethics. Does ethics require impartiality? Critics of egoism, particularly utilitarians, accuse egoists of being biased in favor of oneself without justification. They assert that a scientific ethics must be neutral and impartial. It must take a third-person viewpoint where the self isn't given any special consideration. Are the utilitarians wrong? If so, why should a scientific ethics bias the self over others?
So I actually used to teach this in my undergraduate class. So what I want to do is actually start by reviewing the arguments that I used to teach. There's two major arguments for impartialism. I want to talk about one classic one, John Stuart Mill's argument in utilitarianism, and then a modern one. It's actually really hard to find arguments for this, and because it tends to be a kind of assumption.
Yeah, so let's everybody start. Knows, of
yeah.
course.
It, yeah. 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 So let's start with John Stuart Mill's argument in utilitarianism. So John Stuart Mill, there's arguments that he's giving as to, right before this happens, as to why, like, things that are desired and desirable, and it's well known that there's an equivocation in that argument. So there's problems leading up to this, but then this is the essential argument for why what he calls the general happiness, in other words, the collective happiness, the happiness of everybody, is what we are morally obliged to promote. Okay, so he says, quote, "No reason can be given why the general happiness is desirable, except that each person, so far as he believes it to be attainable, desires his own happiness. This, however, being a fact, we have not only all the proof which the case admits of, but all which it is possible to require, that happiness is a good, that each person's happiness is a good to that person, and the general happiness, therefore, is a good to the aggregate of all persons. Happiness has made out of its title, Happiness has made out its title as one of the ends of conduct and consequently one of the criteria of morality. So basically,
it's a bad argument.
Happiness is a good, so each person is a happiness to that person, and so the general happiness, therefore, is a good to the aggregate of all persons. That's the critical line there. So, you know, like, my happiness is a good to me, Greg, your happiness is good to you. So, you know, they're equally good. It's not that you're better than me or I'm better than you. And morality, like, it requires that we pursue the good. Right, so here we are. We're then equally obliged to pursue everyone's good and not just our own good, or at least as the. It's funny how the argument goes, because it's the aggregate of happiness is good to the aggregate of all people. But does that mean like I'm not obliged to promote the aggregate happiness? It's just the aggregate of all people is. I mean, anyway, so the argument doesn't even get him what he wants, and it's a really really bad argument.
Wow, this is not good.
Yeah. So the one of the major problems here is a fallacy of composition, meaning there's an inference that what is true of the parts of a group must be true of the group as a whole. And that's a fallacy because what's true of parts is often not true of the whole. So, for example, in a classroom, each individual student has a grade, but the whole class doesn't have a grade. Or every flower in a field has petals, but the field of flowers does not have petals, right? There's it's a fallacy of composition. It's also a category error.
Yeah.
So similarly, each individual person has a happiness that's good to them, but a group of people doesn't have a happiness that's good to that collective. A group of people is not some kind of superorganism with its own life and its own good. So a group, whether it's large or small, is merely individuals with their own private thoughts, desires, needs, actions, and happiness interacting with others. There's no aggregate happiness that comes out of that. There's no aggregate organism that comes out of that.
Fascinating that he started with, each person wants to go for their own good. Huh.
Yeah, like that's obvious to him. Right, that's obvious to him, right? We're all pursuing our own happiness. But, and in general, though, also think about this. There's no obligation to act towards a group as we act towards any given individual in it, right? So we can say, look, every husband should love his wife. Or let's say treat his wife with respect or something like that, right? That doesn't imply that every husband should love every wife, nor the sum of all wives, right? Like, we do take particular relationships. Those things matter. And if we're just going to start aggregating everything, all of those particular relationships just disappear. Now, this is probably the worst argument, not just this section that I read, but the section that comes beforehand. It's probably the worst argument in the history of philosophy. And I will say philosophers know this. Like,
yeah, it's pretty weak sauce.
They know that this is like, it's a laughable argument. Even philosophers who are utilitarians think that this is a laughably bad argument.
Yeah. So surely somebody has, cleaned it up a bit and made it awesome for now. What do you have now? Because they know the weakness, right?
Yeah, not so much. So I'm just going to look at Thomas Nagel's argument. There's also an argument that Peter Singer gives, which is also, it's very deeply confused and really, really wrong. If folks want to have me dissect that argument, submit that as a separate question in the queue. Okay, so this is from Thomas Nagel. He's a philosopher, probably one of the most prominent modern philosophers, you know, 20th century philosophers. He would be up there in, let's say, the top 20 somewhere. And particularly his article, I like some of his stuff. His article, What It's Like to Be a Bat, is one of my favorite articles in The Philosophy of Mind. So there's good stuff with Thomas Nagel, but this argument is not it. Okay, so this is a little bit dense. It's a little bit hard to get through, and I've got a lot of ellipses in here because I wanted to condense the argument into something that I could read, something that would be clear. So hopefully this will go okay for you guys. So Thomas Nagel says, is the value of sensory pleasure and pain agent-neutral or agent-relative? Actually, let me pause for a second. He's just going to talk about pleasure and pain here, but he doesn't think that he's not a utilitarian in that sense. He doesn't necessarily think this is the pleasure and pain are the ultimate good. It's just an argumentative strategy for him. So you could think here about, you know, the well-being of the organism or something like that. Okay, let's start again. Quote, is the value of sensory pleasure and pain agent-neutral or agent-relative? I believe it is agent neutral in part. In arguing for this claim, I am somewhat handicapped by the fact that I find it self-evident. It is therefore difficult for me to find something more certain with which to back it up. But I shall try to say what is wrong with rejecting it. The avoidance of pain is not an individual project expressing the agent's personal values. The desire to make pain stop is simply evoked in the person who feels it. I believe that when we think about it objectively, concentrating on what pain is like, and ask ourselves whether it is A, not bad at all, B, bad only for the possessor, or C, bad period, the third answer is the one that needs to be argued against, not the one that needs to be argued for. Consider how strange is the question posed by somebody who wants a justification for altruism about such a basic matter as this. Suppose he and some other people have been admitted to the hospital with severe burns after being rescued from a fire. Quote, I understand how my pain provides me with a reason to take an analgesic, he says, and I understand how my groaning neighbor's pain gives him a reason to take an analgesic. But how does his pain give me a reason to want him to be given an analgesic? How can his pain give me or anyone else looking at it from the outside a reason? This question is crazy. Close quote. So that's the end of Thomas Nagel. So basically the idea here is that Nagel sees, yes, each person has a reason to end their own pain, but that's not objectivity for him, right? If we're going to take an objective perspective, we should see that everybody has a reason just to view pain as bad, period. And this, for him, objectivity requires adopting what he calls the view from nowhere, meaning that we're going to kind of transcend our own limited perspective, all of our own individual beliefs and desires and preferences, and take up kind of a God's eye view. And then we see that what's this thing that's good or bad for you or good or bad for me, it's just good or bad. We shouldn't get mired in our own perspective. That's not what objectivity is. That's not a third person perspective, which is what we need here. And so obviously then, even though you're the one experiencing the pain, I should say, I have a reason for you to want to be given analgesic because pain is just bad. And it doesn't matter that I'm feeling it or not feeling it. But we see here, I mean, in the opening, I left his comments about how he finds this self-evident. It's difficult for him to say something because this is a kind of, it's just this assumption, right? Of course it's true that we need this universal perspective. Of course it's true that we can't just be mired in our own, like, I'm feeling pain right now, and that's morally significant. Greg, do you have any initial thoughts on this? This is new to you.
Oh, good grief.
I'll mention.
This is,
yeah, we talked about this in the production meeting.
Not impressed so far with the argument. Let's say I could put it that way.
Right. So I want to look at two quick objections, and then there's the third, like, really big objection here. So, again, this kind of view, it does violence to our particular relationships with other people. There's no moral grounds here for caring for your own child as opposed to the children of others. So morality requires a kind of indifference to whose good is satisfied. So it would be just as moral to feed a starving child in Africa as to feed your own child. And it would be just as immoral to starve your own child as to allow a starving child in Africa to die. So these personal connections, personal responsibilities just get obliterated under impartialism. There's this desire to get to the altruistic viewpoint, right, where it's not my needs that matter. And in the process, I get to run over my own family with a truck.
And this could be an interesting project for somebody to try to figure out why the desire to stampede in this direction.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, altruism, like, there's almost, and Arthur mentioned this when I talked with him about it, there's a kind of Moton Bailey tactic here where, like, it starts off as being like, well, you should care about other people. And then suddenly you're like, well, wait, I have to let my own child starve because there's, more children in Africa starving? Like, how did we get from, like, be nice to other people to that, right? How did we get there? Okay, second objection. There's none of the room here for any of the personal interests and goals and plans that make life actually worthwhile and that make a person interesting. So there's a real danger here of becoming, under an impartialist viewpoint, this kind of robotic moral saint, which is something that I talked about in a prior episode. And it's one would not wish to be a perfect impartialist. It would actually make you a really horrible person just by, I mean, almost anybody's standards. So that's a warning sign. But the big objection here is that all good has to be good for somebody. That good is a relational concept, that it's relative to particular goals and circumstances, and particularly to the agent, right? So I can say this pencil that I have in my hand, it's good for me because I need it to write. But let's say it's bad for you if you're allergic to the plastic or the eraser or something in it. And it's useless for you if you were hiking through the desert. And what Mill and Nagel and these other impartialists are trying to do is trying to remove the person from the idea of good and thereby remove any of the individual context and circumstances. But various goods are good to individuals. They're good to people in particular. There is not such a thing as plain good, free-floating good, and intrinsically, inherently good that somehow everybody's obliged to pursue. If something is good, it is good for someone for a purpose. And that someone has a reason to pursue it, and other people might have a reason to help the person or care about it or so on, but only in a kind of secondary way, right? It's that person, it's good for that person, and they have a reason to pursue it. And Greg, you had some general comments here. Let me just say, like, this is what we're saying here about these kinds of things. This is straight out of Ayn Rand's essay, The Objectivist Ethics, where she talks about this and this particular problem. And so if you're interested in more on this, by all means, go read that.
Totally recommend Rand here because for me as an engineer, she was very clarifying in this. Her approach made some sense. She asked the meta question, what exactly is ethics for? And looking at the patterns, you know, it's like what she didn't assume that one ought to divorce the actor from the beneficiary, you know, being the actor. She didn't assume that those should be separate. And she just looked at the patterns of behavior. She's like, oh, look at this. Living things have to act to maintain their own existence. Well, that's an important bit of data. And in our case, as she noticed that, look, we can choose to not act to maintain our own existence. And that's where we get questions of morality. What are you up to and why? So all these arguments are very frustrating to me because having been exposed to this meta question of exactly what is this for in the first place? Oh, yeah, it's to maintain your own existence. If you want to stay in existence, you need to do the right things. Otherwise, you won't stay in existence. That's what seems pretty obvious now, but I don't have to just say that it seems so obvious that I don't have an argument for it. I can point to all the living things out there and say, look, every one of these things, their lives are conditional. They have to do the right thing. Otherwise, they stop existing as living things. That's true of us, too, just like all the others. Oh, we have free will. That's an additional wrinkle. And we need to do it like humans, then. We're principled. We have to make choices. We have a code of behavior to maintain our existence. And there's a whole nice, a very nice argument that she lays out in that article.
Right. Yeah.
So
and one of the
much
things-
more sane approach to me as an engineer.
Yes. Well, one of the things that matters here is that other people are really of value to us. And that includes particular other people, but humanity in general, that one is much better off living in society with other productive people doing their own productive things and than you are on a desert island trying to survive all by yourself. And this is certainly something that Rand's ethics recognizes. And that explains that means that part of being an egoist, caring for other people and caring, oftentimes having this global view where you sort of care about the welfare of humanity in a way. And certainly, if you're confronted with somebody else suffering on the level of you have horrible burns from a fire, like you should have any morally decent person, any morally decent egoist will have cultivated feelings of benevolence that you would not wish somebody to suffer, that would be painful for you to hear. And of course you would want to give them a painkiller. Of course you would want that. but not because you're being an impartialist in ethics, but because you have this well-developed understanding of the value of other people and that you can sympathize with them in this natural way because you're also experiencing similar kinds of pain or you have in the past. But that's very different from saying we need to take an impartial perspective and not care whose good it is.
Yeah. And
no,
and
it's
even,
his good
even,
and I care about it. That's yeah. like that's all that morality requires here.
So, yeah, what are they thinking? Egos is like, oh yeah, you should give him a painkiller because you know what? Hearing his screaming over there is really inconvenient for me.
Yeah.
Seriously?
I think that's what they imagine. That's really
yeah.
what people imagine. But that's not true.
No.
It should be like gut-wrenchingly painful to hear somebody in that amount of pain.
Yeah, for somebody who's really an egoist, people are really valuable. People are awesome.
Right.
And so the default reaction would be empathy. You wouldn't sacrifice yourself to help somebody out. So it's not doesn't go without limits. And if it's the wrong kind of person, if it's some truly evil, rotten person who really needed to not stay in existence, it's like, well, yeah, good riddance over there.
Right.
So it's not an absolute. It's always appropriate.
It's Hitler who's been burned, I'm not.
Yeah.
You know.
Not gonna mind. It's like, yeah, that's a rough one for you, Hitler.
Right. That's a rough one for you, Hitler. There we go. I might have some more choice words, but yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I'll just mention here, and I've said this before, but egoism, like I as an egoist do not say everybody else should sacrifice themselves to me or like I want all the goodies or that, like that's not what egoism is about. Egoism is about me being the center of my own moral universe. But I also recognize that every other person is the center of their own moral universe, or at least they should be. And so that part of that is respecting their rights, but also respecting their, you know, their wishes and their preferences and their autonomy as a person, you know, not trying to manipulate them or control them in that way. And so this is how egoism is universal. If you have a bunch of egoists in a room, that you have a bunch of incompatible, like, moral theories here. No, you have each person would say, yes, you should be honest, you should be just, you should be, you know, benevolent, you should be doing all of these things. But each person rightly regards themselves as the primary beneficiary of their own actions.
Yeah. And it makes sense. They're living creatures just making their way in reality, trying to stay in reality, and so they need to be focused on that important work for
right.
them. It's important to them. Yeah.
And they are certainly in the best position to figure out what's the best thing for them and to actually go after that. That's one of the things that bugs me about altruism is the sheer inefficiency of it. Right? It's like I'm not allowed to pursue what I think is best for me and you're not allowed to pursue what's best for you. Instead, we have to try to figure out what's best for the other person and match that, right? It's like giving gifts, right? I'm you know, like sometimes gifts are really nice and I'm not saying that they're not good, right? But you know, sometimes that sweater from grandma is just not what you
like
would have
really,
wanted.
Really, you can't pick clothes and art for me as well as I can.
Right.
So why go through all of that when instead I actually have a really good motivation for pursuing actions that'll preserve my existence.
Right.
And I'm right there, I can do it.
Yep. You have, like, you've got the knowledge, you've got the skills, you've got the capacity, and altruism is going to come in and say, no, 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 you're not allowed to do that, right? You should go be helping other people. Oftentimes people you don't know, and, yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
The inefficiency of it drives me crazy.
Indeed. Okay.
I think that's it. Let's
goofy.
Go to the take-home
yeah. point. Yeah, what's the take-home point?
So impartialism in ethics attempts to disconnect the good from the agent, thereby oblige people to promote everyone's good, not just their own. But the arguments for that are weak, and the results are actually pretty appalling. Ethics should be partial in the sense that ethics should promote the good of the agent, but they should also be universal and benevolent, too.
Excellent. And we have a little bit of follow-up stuff. So Trey asks, is there some problem with his view of objectivity? I think he's talking about Nagel.
Nagel, yeah.
It sounds a little odd in the quote.
Yes, there's lots and lots of problems with his view of objectivity. His view of objectivity, it is this, it's not my view of objectivity is me, like, as a human person, struggling to recognize the facts, to conceptualize well. Like, it's being fact-oriented and using my conceptual consciousness, exercising my volition in the right ways to get at the correct answers, to get at the truth. And to be doing that really scrupulously and carefully and so on. That is not what Nagel wants us to do. Nagel wants us to, like, step outside of ourselves and take this God's eye view. And as a result, he has really, really weird views on things like free will and so on. And I actually discussed this in my book, because the thing I actually forgot to mention about Thomas Nagel is that he's the author of The Problem of Moral Luck. And so his proposed solution to it, you see his views on this topic go, like, you're like, what? Wait, like, what is it you're thinking of? I can't.
Crazy,
like,
sauce.
This is crazy sauce. So yes, this whole, and it's very similar to John Rawls's view of the veil of ignorance. This idea that being objective requires stepping outside of yourself. It's very Kantian, and.
Yeah.
And Nagel is actually very explicitly very Kantian. He's definitely got this noumenal phenomenal distinction going on, and it's just a mess. It's a mess. It's yeah.
And again, to my ears, that is really bizarre, because it's removing the whole need for knowledge in the first place. I, as an agent in reality, am seeking knowledge for a particular reason. So I have an interest in it. I can't step outside of myself and lose that context. I need the knowledge, to, you know, so I can navigate reality.
Right.
There's a purpose for that. It's not detached from an agent. It exists because of the agent. So yeah. It's a little rough. Anyway, very frustrating. Okay, then Stuart asks, is the impartial God's eye view that Nagel is taking influenced by Kant or Smith, Adam Smith? Either of these pioneer in saying that in moral decisions you must take the God's eye view rather than your own personal subjective view, or did this come from them? I think.
So I don't know Adam Smith. He's not widely read in moral philosophy, and I would doubt that Nagel would be influenced by him. But I don't know. I'm pretty sure the answer there is no. Nagel is, as I just mentioned, Nagel is definitely a Kantian. So, but it's not, Kant does not ever say, like, you have to understand how philosophical influence works over the course of centuries. It's not that Kant said you should take the God's eye view for morality and Nagel picked that up. No, that's not how that works. Rather, Kant has this whole noumenal phenomenal distinction and all the sort of metaphysics that goes with that, and Nagel has and epistemology that goes with that, and Nagel has taken that up in a new modern way with his subjective objective distinction, and made use of this again and again in his analysis of all kinds of issues, and that hasn't gone super well. Like, the What It's Like to Be a Bat is a great article, and it's a great use of this objective subjective distinction. It actually works in that case, but for so much else, it's a nightmare in terms of just such a bad way of approaching the philosophical issue. And so you can say, like, yes, Nagel is a Kantian. He's been influenced by Kant in these very deep kinds of ways, but not in this superficial way, in a much more fundamental and complicated and fairly interesting way.
Okay. And KPOM asks, can you say that the people who attacked the gunman on the train last week were being impartial in some respects?
Okay, so I haven't looked at – I don't know much about this story. I've been meaning to read up on it. But there's this general question of, like, you know, the people who – you know, there's a terrorist on the plane, and, you know, people attack him, and, you know, some of those people might get injured, they might die. This is a deep misunderstanding of what goes on in these kind of circumstances. Now, of course, people can be motivated by all kinds of things. These guys could be impartialists, they could be altruists, they could be whatever. But when you are in that kind of life-threatening situation, it's very likely if there's a gunman on a train, you are going to end up dead. Right, and if you have the skills, as these guys did, they were trained in jiu-jitsu, among other things. If you have the skills to actually stop that and to stop the slaughter, like, that's the only way you're going to survive, right? So it's wrong to take it out of context and think, oh, look, you just risked your life. You must be an altruist. No, this is actually how you save your life, potentially, is by being the person who's you know, maybe willing to run at the guy and attack him first.
Indeed. Okay. Nothing else there, it looks like. So it's time for the reminder about the tip jar.
So Philosophy in Action Radio, not just the live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide. We do that with every show to thousands of listeners, but we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please do contribute to our tip jar. Visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. You can also create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay, and then you don't need to remember, and you also get free access to Philosophy in Action's premium content, and we really appreciate that regular support. Again, you can do that at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Changing names with marriage. Should I change my name when I marry? I'm a gay man who is engaged to be married. The question has come up about whether or not either of us would change our last name, and historically we've said no. We have thought that we would just maintain our given names. My fiancé doesn't want to change his name, and we both think trying to hyphenate our last names would be unwieldy and fussy. But as we've talked about planning a family in the future, it's occurred to me that I actually like the idea of sharing a name with my husband and my children. So I've been considering changing my name. Somewhat ironically, however, changing my name means giving up a 5-generation-old family name in order to take on the name of our new family. I don't mind this irony very much, since my decision would be about taking on a family I choose rather than one I didn't. What do you think? What pros and cons do you see for changing your name at marriage? Do you see any additional pros or cons for gay men considering this question?
So I have some personal experience here. Obviously, I changed my name to Paul's last name when we got married. Now, Paul was not – he didn't insist on that in any way, shape, or form. He would have been perfectly happy for me to stay as Diana Brickle. But – I wanted to do it for similar reasons as to the questioner. I wanted us to be a unit, right? I wanted us to be Paul and Diana Shea. Now, obviously, Paul and I were getting divorced, and so I'm changing my name back to Diana Brickle. It's like Shea is such a it's truly a horrible last name. Sorry, Paul. It's so difficult to spell. Nobody knows how to pronounce it. And then also there is this sense of like, look, I'm not married to this person anymore. I really want my old name back. I did think about changing my name to some third thing, but I like Brickle well enough. And, I don't know. There's nothing that I would pick. Like there was no options that I was like, oh, that's the last name I really want. But I will say, The only reason why I regret changing my name is what a huge pain it is to change it back. And people think about like, oh, you've got to change your credit cards and all that kind of stuff. No, that's nothing. It's that I have this massive online social identity, which is all needing to change back to Diana Brickle. And so that's a huge pain in the ass. But I'm, you know, thinking back on it, like if I had to make the choice over again, you can't say like knowing what I know now, like things would have been like the name change wouldn't have come up in a way. But you know, I don't regret the choice that I made at the time. I think it was the right choice to make, as much as it's going to be a pain to switch back. But this is one of the issues, right? Not all relationships last forever. A lot of marriages don't. And what are you going to think if you get divorced, and how hard will it be to change your name back? I think it's really hard to do that kind of contingency planning when you're marrying somebody, because the thought is this is going to be forever. But it's not always forever, and I think that that's something at least to consider. Now, Greg, you and Tammy changed her name when you two got married, so tell us about that.
Yeah, her name when I met her was Tammy Ryan. And she wasn't originally Ryan. She was a Tosdale growing up. Then she got married, McConnell. And when she divorced, she decided, well, I'm no longer McConnell, much like you're talking about. So she's like, I don't want to be McConnell. And because she was thinking of herself as moving forward through life, she's like, I'm not really a Tosdale in the same way anymore. So she designed a new last name for herself. She consciously chose a single syllable strong male name, Ryan. And it's a fantastic name. And it was such a fantastic name then when we got married or were fiancés, we looked really closely at it's like Greg Ryan. That's a great name. I like that. That very very strong. I would have loved to be Greg Ryan. But the problem is, in our culture, it really is common for women to change their names with marriage. People understand it. It's not shocking to them. They get the pattern. And it's not common for men to change their names. So it would just be confusing and goofy. And we decided, well, like Perkins well enough, okay, we'll stick with that. And Tammy, the solution, again, followed our sort of cultural patterns. We didn't go with the goofy hyphening thing. She shifted her last name to her middle name and took on Perkins because she really, having screened our family, decided, okay, I can be a part of that tribe and we can be Team Perkins.
Yep.
And so she's Tammy Ryan Perkins now. And anybody in our culture hearing that name who knew her as Tammy Ryan would know instantly what happened. So it works out.
Right. Yeah, I will say one of the things that I did, I ended up legally now, I was Diana Mertz Shea, but my maiden name is Diana Mertz Brickle. I didn't like how Diana Brickle Shea sounded, so that's why I swapped things out the way that I did.
Being confused by the whole Mertz thing. I was like, what is this Mertz name in here?
Yeah, and people would hyphenate that and so on, and it was a bit of a pain. But I did like how that sounded. And Mertz is actually the last name of my step-grandfather, whereas Brickle is the last name of my grandfather. But my step-grandfather is the only one I knew. I never knew my grandfather Brickle for various reasons related to him not being such a fabulous person. So, like, I actually felt more affinity to the Mertz middle name in a way, as much as, you know, growing up, I grew up as one of the Brickle girls, and it's not like ancestry mattered in that case.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm right now I'm sort of in this weird state because I'm half Diana Brickle and half Diana Shea still. And so I'm sort of using one socially and the other for
in legal context
legally,
or whatever.
Yeah. Anyway, it is just a bit, a bit odd right now.
Are there any philosophical angles here?
Yeah, this is not a deeply philosophical question, but as with every choice, right, there are moral dimensions here. I think it would be wrong for one person, and this particularly applies to women, I think, in marriage, in heterosexual marriages, it would be wrong for the woman to change her name just because that's what people do, right? It is a major undertaking to change your name, and it shouldn't be done lightly or just because that's traditional. There's lots of other options. For example, one of the things you can do is use your husband's last name socially but not change it legally, because that would give you a sense of, here, look, we're this unit, but, you know, legally I'm still, you know, on my driver's license and so on, I'm still my quote-unquote maiden name. And it's something to consider, like, how old are you and how much, you know, how much are you accepted in your like, how much do you have a reputation in your community or in your profession that you want to make sure you maintain and so on. So there's those kinds of considerations that are really worth considering and not just, well, people expect me to change my name. Secondly, and I think this actually applies more in the context of gay marriage, of men changing their name, families can get really, really weird about name changes, right? It's very acceptable for a woman to change her name in marriage, but in any other circumstances, people can freak out. They can feel like they have been rejected or the family has been rejected. And I know this from people, from men who change their names for their own reasons. You know, like they just didn't like their last name and they wanted a new last name, and so they changed their last name. And their family, like, it was a big deal for their family. And so I think that in that case, if you know, you're doing it not because your family is a bunch of psychopaths, but you do actually love them, but you just want a new last name, you can explain your reasons kindly, you can reassure them, but their freaking out is not going to be should not be a reason for you not to change your name.
We had a little experience in that one too. Again, it's culturally dependent. We had Tammy's son wanted to design his own last name, and it was pretty cool. He was just graduating from college. It was fitting time. And we were like, awesome, let's help you pick an awesome name. And other people in his family were hurt by it.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I would expect from you too. So good job. The final thing that I would mention, the final philosophical, the final, like, deep, important moral point is that hyphenated names are evil. Right?
Oh, they are. This is not a sustainable policy.
Yeah, it's unsustainable. It's awkward. It's horrible. No, no, no on the hyphenated names. So that's an absolute moral principle. Don't do those.
Absolute moral principle.
Yes.
It's a sin to hyphenate names.
It's not just a sin. It's not a venial sin. It's a moral
grave
sin.
Moral sin, grave sin.
Yeah. Okay, so then after that, like, you know, sort of once you have those moral issues in play, right, or once you have those nailed down, there's just some practicalities here, right? Like, how much do you like your name versus your future husband's name? Is either name actually more or less common? Like, one of the nice things about changing my name back to Diana Brickle is I don't believe there's another one in existence. So there were Diana Shays, and so I used to, like, new services would come up, and I'd quickly register Diana Shay as my username so that I would have that. Whereas Diana Brickle, I was able to get dianabrickle@gmail.com. Like, who can do that these days, right? So that was super awesome. Another question, as I mentioned, like, how old are you? Are you embedded in your profession under your current name? Do you have major social media presence under your current name? And that you can still change your name, even if so. Obviously, I'm changing my name, even though I have major social media presence and I'm embedded in my profession. Everybody knows me by Diana Shay. But that's just something to consider. Is this really something that you want to do now?
And that was a consideration in my case, too. It's like, oh, I have patents in my name. People have known me this way for, you know, I'm well into my career.
Yeah. You weren't in your early 20s.
No.
Yeah. I do think it's relevant. Do you want everybody in your family, especially your kids, to have the same last name? If that feels important for family identity, that's, like, that's a good reason to change your name. That's okay. That's I like Team Perkins. And one thing you can do if you decide, again, if you decide you don't want to change your name, is you can use that name socially. You can do other things to make you have that family identity. Like, you can have a name for your family that's like, we are the so-and-sos, and have that be some kind of, like, weird, funny, blended thing, right? But that's not like having a hyphenated name. It's not legally hyphenated, but it's just a funny thing of, like, here's the people that we are. Here's our tribe. Another thing is, you know, look, how much do you actually like your husband's family, right? Maybe you do want to distance yourself a little bit from your own family. So sometimes it can be, like, joining his clan, and I think that can be good for people who have a bad family history with their own family, and they really like their husband's family or their spouse's family. That can be something like, yeah, this is what I want to do. I want to join these set of people. I'm done with these set of people back here. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of options here. There's lots of things to consider. And, you know, but I don't think it's like there's no right or wrong answer here. It's a lot of personal preference and what matters to you.
Yeah. So it's a nice build your spreadsheet of your preferences and maybe cultural leanings and junk like that. Gotta say, Trey McIntyre. We have here in our town, there's the Trey McIntyre Project, which is a dance troupe. And those guys are awesome. And Trey McIntyre is a strong name.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
almost
I like, and also,
Fred Ryan.
I've also known Trey by, like, six different names over the course of the years, so, like, having a new one will be no big deal. But I will say, I totally forgot what I was just about to say. Now that train just left the station without me.
The awesomeness of Trey McIntyre?
I just don't. It's gone. It's really gone. Sorry, folks.
All right. Well, do you have a take-home point?
I do. So, basically, if you decide to change your name, make sure to do it or not do it for good reasons. There we go.
Fair enough.
No. Oh, I remember what I was going to say. You had said, like, get out your spreadsheet and so on. And I'm like, oh, God, that sounds horrible. I think, in part, one of the things you can do is just, like, don't try to make this rush decision with it, right? Just think about, like, okay, would I be okay with this name? And let it sort of percolate. Let it kind of wash over you for a little while before you make the decision about, would I be okay being Diana Brickle again? Am I okay being Diana Shay? Like, what is it that I want to do here? And just sit with that and see how that fits you. At least for me, that's what's tended to work.
I guess I was joking about the spreadsheet, but you know, it has some value in that it makes you pause and consider lots of angles. Like, okay, is there a cultural thing? Do I have any work things? What do my friends think about this? Is it a strong name? Does it, all the different factors you might think about? And yeah, like you're saying, settle into it. Tammy did that. Right. Worked out. All right. Doesn't look like any follow-up other than just lots of fun comments in the chat.
I think we need to save the third question for next week.
Saving it up. Okay.
Because we've got 15 minutes left, and I'd like to do some rapid fire, and I think this question will take 20 minutes, so I think I'd rather wait on this one.
Okay. Moving on then. It's rapid fire question time. I'll be putting Diana on the hot seat, asking questions from this long and growing queue in any old order. I don't even know the order. I haven't even had my eyes fall on this list. We'll see what happens. It could be much more interesting than the prepared answers. Let's see. Okay. On commissioning art, what about the morality of commissioning fan art of work not yet in the public domain? Like a drawing of Superman or a super short short story about Ragnar Danishjold. I don't know how to pronounce his name. He's always the Dread Pirate Ragnar to me. This would not be for publication, just for yourself. So commissioning something for yourself. What do you think about that?
I don't see a big problem with that. We talked in the past about, there was a question that somebody had asked about commissioning art, and I was like, I don't know what's the moral issue here? And this definitely is like, oh, okay, here's a moral issue. Like, that's a question. I don't know. I don't actually know what the law allows for, like whether this would constitute fair use. Generally, and I don't think there's a problem so much with being the commissioner. There might be more of a problem with being the artist who does this. And this is one of the things that we see, let's say, in fan fiction circles. Now, technically speaking, fan fiction does violate copyright, right? So if I write a fan fiction story involving the Harry Potter characters, I'm technically, like, I'm using this intellectual property that belongs to J.K. Rowling, and, you know, that's a violation of copyright. But the standard, which I actually rather like, and the standard that most authors use, is they say, look, write all the fan fiction you want, but you can't make money off of it. If you're going to make money off of it, then there's a copyright claim that we've got to talk about. So basically, like, go ahead and have a great time with my universe. That's all good, but don't piggyback on my creation financially. And I like that as a policy that authors have. And so that's why I would be worried about the artist in this case, because basically they are in fact then earning money, piggybacking off of somebody else's artistic creation.
Yeah, I would say the whole reason for these kinds of laws is that you're protecting that intellectual property. So one, if you're going out and making your living on somebody else's intellectual property against their wishes, that's not cool. Mm-hmm. And there's another consideration too, and that is, well, sure, you're doing it for personal use and you're not making a bunch of money off of it, but if you're messing up their intellectual property, if you're harming them with it by, fan fiction literatica, where you're making a mess of their stuff, that's also uncool.
Well, it depends on whether they're okay with that or not. I mean, like,
yeah, yeah,
like,
against their wishes, it's always
flash fiction has a long glorious tradition. You know, the Spock Kirk stories. Anyway, but again, it depends on whether, like, you know, it's one thing for this to be done, you know, like, oh, okay, like in the background people can find this if they want it. It's another thing for this to be like sitting on the shelf with Star Trek books. So I think let's say if I was gonna have, you know, if I had a friend who might do this, if it was a kind of like very private personal project and I might compensate him a little bit for his time or something like that, like, I wouldn't regard that as a big problem. But if somebody is earning their living doing this, you know, doing drawings of Superman and compromising poses or non-compromising poses, whatever it is, that seems to me that they are crossing a line there, and I would not wish to participate in that.
Okay. Moving on. Hey, what's your opinion of the anthropic principle that observations of the physical universe must be compatible with the conscious life that observes it, unquote? So does it beg the question?
Yeah, there we go. So
there's both strong and weak.
It's trivially true, right? This is the problem. It's that principle is trivially true. The problem is saying something along the lines of God must exist because if the universe were just slightly different, then we wouldn't exist. And obviously we're here. So God must have tinkered with the universe to make it such that we could exist. So it's obviously true that the universe is such that it supports life and Earth supports the kind of life that it does. But you cannot infer from that anybody made the universe that way in order to get us as their goal. That's the strong versus weak anthropic principle, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I was going to say they refer to both of those as strong and weak. So, yeah, weak one, trivially true. Strong one, not warranted.
Right.
Moving on. Okay. Hey, what are oaths? Are they just romantic elements for fiction or real things that are useful in some way?
I don't know what is meant by this. Oaths, obviously that can just mean swearing.
I swear by my life and my love of it.
There's those kinds of oaths, like the promises,
Oh, maybe just a blood oath kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, the question is, in part, let's say you swear in that kind of in this ceremonial kind of way, right? I think that's what's meant in the question. How binding is that? Obviously, let's take the marriage case, right? People who get married get up and promise to love and do all the other things and, till death do us
forever
part,
and ever.
Generally.
Yeah.
And then people get divorced, right? I think that, but it used to be, yes, that was it. You weren't getting divorced. And now that's not true anymore. And certainly life is so much better now that that's not true. I think oftentimes what oaths are is a statement of intention and a statement to I'm going to live my life so that this can happen. This can continue happening. I will continue to live my life in this way. But that doesn't mean that if circumstances change, that one is bound and obliged to keep doing the thing that no longer makes sense anymore. And there might have to be a kind of reckoning in the sense of something public and something changes. And it's not, it's not just, for example, with Paul and I and the end of the marriage that I just got to run off and start dating other people. That's not how that works, right? Because there was this promise, this commitment, this kind of oath, there are things that one has to do in order to get out of it. There's a kind of process. There's a kind of openness and upfrontness and a slow change that happens because of that.
Yeah. So that these public promises do seem useful in laying on the importance. It makes it not casual.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I think that can be important. I'm having going through what Paul and I are going through now. I guess I'm a little bit more skeptical of the value of these things. And I think that they can also have real harm in that even if you're trying to always do the right thing in terms of staying true to yourself and being self-interested, nonetheless, these kinds of oaths, these kinds of promises can implicitly or subconsciously bind you in certain ways that are actually quite harmful to you. So I guess I would be very careful about future oaths of this kind, future, the ways in which I bind myself. Because at least for me particularly, I know that I tend to do that very wholeheartedly, and that might not be the right thing to do. So I think there's some caution. On the one hand, these things have value. On the other hand, there's some caution warranted.
Okay. Do you believe that there are unconscious parts of the human mind? If so, what implications does this have for free will?
Obviously there's things that I forget, right? That I can't recall at this very moment or those kinds of things. The hidden deep subconscious stuff. And there might be, let's say there's a childhood memory that I've actually forgotten the memory, but there can be kind of lingering effects or lingering echoes from that. But I don't think that there's whole unconscious parts of the mind that are actually like operating and
driving you this way and that.
Yeah. I don't think that that's. I don't think we have any evidence that that's how things are working. I think that was Freud's flight of fancy.
Yeah, but we do have lots and lots, just endless gobs of automatized things going on, from memories swimming up, associations being made.
Yeah,
the way I'm stringing together words in this sentence right now in real time, I'm not carefully considering all these different words. They're swimming up, and I'm stringing it together. So, and that's all automatized prior work. So. In that sense, that's all unconscious, but it's trained. And I think for free will, the thing is that, well, while it swims up, I'm not obliged to accept it. I can arrest it and
right.
not use it.
Right. And
sometimes
you can also
those are the pauses you hear when I'm saying things.
You can also think about things more and figure them out and decide what you want to do and go see a therapist and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Instead of accepting the thing that's swimming up, I can go, no, wait a minute. 12 times 27, that's not that. It's and work it out explicitly.
Right.
So, yeah. Doesn't seem like a danger for free will, at least to me.
No.
I'm still in charge.
I don't know that you can reconcile free will and moral responsibility with a Freudian view of the mind. I think there's a conflict there, but I don't think that Freudian view of the mind is correct.
Yeah. So it's not an issue. Cool. All right. Are all people interdependent, and what does that mean? Well, is this somebody who's maybe worried about the whole independence versus interdependence thing, or?
Yeah. Greg, by the way, I'm getting a horrible echo. Sorry.
Damn you, Skype.
I know. So I hate this claim of interdependence. Is that supposed to be different than just dependence? I mean, look, we need other people. We need them for survival reasons. We need them for psychological reasons. And there's nothing wrong with needing other people. There's nothing wrong with saying, like, I need you. My life wouldn't be the same without you. I'm not sure that I could, you know, do this without you. There's healthy and unhealthy forms of that, obviously. But this whole interdependence... It just, like, I don't know, it's this way of skirting the issue of what independence means and where that should be exercised and how that should be exercised. And it's this way of denying that people get things done on their own. And that, analysis of the concept, but that I don't like. It seems like it's muddying the waters rather than clarifying them.
Interesting. Yeah. All right. Final one. Benjamin
sure.
Franklin wrote letters to his brother's newspaper posing as a widow named Silence Duguid. The original sock puppet account.
Yes.
If you met Franklin in person, would you find him untrustworthy?
So, first of all, this used to be a somewhat standard practice. Okay, no. First of all,
awesome.
Anybody who thinks that Silence Duguid is somebody's real freaking name is an idiot, right? So it was obviously an anonymous pseudonym.
That's about
right?
the same as anonymous coward as like the two
right.
names.
Mm-hmm. Right. So first of all, there's that. So you should know, we don't actually know who this person is. Secondly, it used to be common to do this kind of thing. And actually, my favorite example of this, and I should look up the actual story, but so David Hume didn't just write philosophy. He also wrote histories. And that was actually what he was known for more during his lifetime. He was not known as a philosopher. But he wrote sock puppet reviews of his own books.
Oh,
yep.
Not smooth.
Yep. But like people used to do this stuff and it was sort of more, I don't know, it was more acceptable maybe. I don't know.
The actual sock puppet reviews of his own book when people might actually mistake it for a real person.
Yeah.
Not him.
Yeah.
That seems not cool.
David Hume. But I do think that this kind of thing happened more often and it was more acceptable. It was not. Like, we now have, like, our idea of scholarly standards is very, very recent. Because Hume doesn't cite things. He doesn't have footnotes. He doesn't, like, all these other things that we would regard as essential for good scholarship. These are things that are very, very new.
But that's straight up fraud.
No. I agree. This is not the right thing for him to do. I agree. But, dude, you're a writer trying to make a living, you know, like, I don't know. It's Hume. It's just so in the past. So kind of big deal. Right. If somebody did that today, I would be like, dude, what the hell? Right.
Yeah. And that's where today, if somebody is using an obvious pseudonym, I don't have an objection, but if they're posing as an actual independent person and pimping their own stuff, hey, that's fraud.
That's really bad. That's really bad. And also, if people are engaged in debates under a pseudonym when they're also involved as their regular self, like, that's also very uncool. And for me, it's not like I haven't been tempted to do that sometimes, which is why I have an absolute rule that I'm always myself online. I'm always using the account with my own name, et cetera, because the temptation to go and screw with people can get a little bit high when people are saying horrible things about you on the internet, which happens to me periodically, as folks know. And so, like, I just have to have it as this absolute rule that I cannot go do that, because it would be bad for me psychologically to do it, even if I was never caught. And it would be really bad for me if I was exposed. It would be a big blow to my reputation, and rightly so.
And there is a bit of a slippery slope there, and maybe that's what you're trying to avoid, because you could start with innocent uses of alternate accounts, and in that one pinch, you might cross that line of, like, trying to nudge public opinion by having yet another voice come in support of you, quote-unquote. You've had some experience with people sock puppeting around you in the past, too.
Really, have I? I can't remember that.
NB?
Oh, yeah. Nathaniel Brandon posed as a girlfriend.
Yeah, not cool.
Yeah, it was pretty freaking funny. No, first he posted as a stranger, then he got caught, basically, because he wasn't super computer savvy, and he claimed he was his girlfriend. And, yeah, anyway, it was...
No, it's highly inappropriate.
Pretty,
it's like, the bottom line is...
pathetic. It was just
you're
pathetic.
You're trying to fool people.
Right.
To get something you haven't earned. It's like, that's the definition of not honest. Don't do it.
Yeah, I don't know. But it's just pathetic. Like, don't you have better things to do with your time? And that's the reason why doing that kind of thing would be harmful, psychologically harmful to me as well. It's not just a reputation issue.
Yeah. Yep. All right, moving on. Because it's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you all had a great time.
I had a fantastic time. Once again, thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
Remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well and what we could do better, too. Just send all the complaints straight to diana@philosophyinaction.com, and she'll share the good ones with me.
Yeah. If you want to see what's on tap in the next few weeks, visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming.
I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. The show features Dr. Diana Brickle, and you can read her blog Noodle Food at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.